Good morning and welcome to Beyond the Headlines on CIUT 89.5 FM. I am your host, Elena Villabona Palomero, with my co-producer, Andrew McKay. Beyond the Headlines is a weekly current affairs show that aims to make public policy discussions more accessible to you. We take you beyond the headlines of our daily news, bringing you access to current leaders through in-depth interviews. You can join us in the conversation by tweeting at Beyond Headlines. That's BYOND _ headlines. Trigger warning. This episode includes content dealing with upsetting, sensitive, and potentially triggering themes, including institutionalized modes of oppression, sexual violence, and violence against children. Today's episode delves into the history and enduring consequences of Canada's residential school system, with a focus on understanding the systemic abuses inflicted upon Indigenous children and communities. We examine the roots of the residential school system and its devastating effects on Indigenous cultures and identities. In the first segment, Kayla Johnston provides an overview of the history of residential schools in Canada, discussing their role within the broader context of colonialism and the suppression of Indigenous cultures. She also explains the methods used within the system to suppress Indigenous languages and cultures, and clarifies the term cultural genocide. Kayla addresses common misunderstandings about residential schools, emphasizing the importance of acknowledging their impact on Indigenous communities. Tyler Pennock then discusses the long-term impact of residential schools on Indigenous communities, focusing on intergenerational trauma and cultural loss. They emphasize the crucial need for Canadians to acknowledge and confront the truth of residential schools for reconciliation. Tyler also discusses Indigenous storytelling and knowledge, providing guidance for non-Indigenous Canadians seeking to educate themselves further. Our first guest is Kayla Johnston, Supervisor of Education, Outreach, and Public Programming at the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation. A Cree woman, Kayla's work focuses on supporting educators, developing resources, and engaging the public on the legacy of residential schools. With experience from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission and academic credentials in criminal justice and international crimes, Kayla brings a unique and invaluable perspective. Kayla, thank you so much for joining our podcast today. Can you provide an overview of the history of residential schools in Canada, especially for those who might be new to this topic?
Yes, of course. So when it comes to an overview, or really a brief history of the residential schools, why they were created, you can describe them as a network of boarding schools, primarily for First Nations children, but these institutions also took in Inuit and Métis children, and it's estimated there were about 150,000 Indigenous children across Canada who attended these institutions from about the 1800s until the 1990s. Now, these institutions, they were funded and run by the Canadian federal government, but also by Christian churches like the Catholic Church and the United Church. And I also wanted to just put a little dot in there to say that there are a great number of unrecognized residential schools that were run by the provinces or territories or the churches alone. Now, the Canadian government and the churches both said that the role of the residential school system, its aim, its purpose, was to civilize and Christianize Indigenous children. So the school system was created for the purpose of removing the children from the influence of their own community culture to better assimilate them. Now, when put into practice, what that meant was that it was an attack on Indigenous culture, language, spiritual beliefs, and practices.
Thank you so much. How do residential schools fit into the larger historical context of colonialism and the marginalization of Indigenous peoples in Canada?
When it comes to where do residential schools fit, when we take a look at the history of colonialism in Canada, they fall alongside other institutions, much like the federal day schools, the segregated medical care system we had in Canada, like Indian hospitals and sanatoriums, all of which were built to erase Indigenous identity. Now, these actually worked in tandem or alongside of each other. So if you ask an Indigenous family or community, typically you will find that they've been impacted by more than one of these systems. They're likely having residential school survivors in their family who might also be federal day school survivors, who might have caught tuberculosis at one of the institutions, and so they were sent for treatment in a sanatorium. And then that also leads into things like the development of the child welfare system in Canada and what we call the 60s scoop, which was the forced removal of children from home and then placed into the child welfare system and either adopted out to non-Indigenous families or cycling through the system. So when we take a look at all these systems, we find that they are very much interconnected with one another. They don't stand apart as singular entities, although oftentimes we're mainly focusing on, say, the history of one of those systems compared to the other. So they're all connected together in this great big blanket of colonialism across Canada.
Thank you so much for your answer. And could you elaborate on the methods used in this system to suppress Indigenous cultures and languages, and how does that still affect Indigenous communities today?
I would say one of the biggest challenges that we find today is that people do recognize this history and what occurred, but oftentimes they have a difficult time connecting to the longstanding legacy or impacts of those systems. They don't often see how that history connects to present day circumstances. So that's a very good question to ask, is how did this occur? What methods did they use? And how does it continue to impact communities today? So starting with residential schools, or I should say focusing on residential schools, that assault on identity happened as soon as the child arrived. They would be stripped of belongings, they'd be roughly bathed, examined for vermin, braided hair which held spiritual significance would be cut. If they didn't already have a Christian name, one would be given to them. And they were also given a number, and oftentimes those children were referred to by a number rather than by name, which is very dehumanizing. And so they would be forced to speak English or French, and they would be severely punished for speaking their Indigenous language. In addition to that, cultural practices, ceremonies like the potlatch, those were banned in 1885, and that wasn't reversed until 1951. Now, in addition to that, if parents, if guardians, if they didn't send their children to a day school or a boarding school or residential school, they could be fined, jailed, or even have their food rations reduced. Now, children who were then taken from home or were placed in those institutions because the Indian agent deemed that those parents or guardians were not taking care of them, that is, sending them to school, well, they could actually be institutionalized until the age of 18. Although that bracket of age when we expect to see those children in the residential school is about between the ages of 7 and 16. But I can tell you, we found children or students much older than that. The oldest student I ever found was 23 years old. And the youngest I've ever found were babies at 1 and 2 years old. And there is a wide variety of reasons why there might be children younger and older. For those really young children, it could be something has happened at home where one or both parents or other family members are unable to take care of the children, so they're taken to an institution that can care for them. I have seen children adopted out, but I have also seen them return back home. And for those older children, or I should say those older students, really, they're no longer children once we hit the age of 20, really, they're there either taking high school level classes in a school that could provide them at the time, or living in residence and taking, say, a business course in town. And so the removal of those children from homes, either to be placed in residential school or even through the 60s scoop role, really, that was the precursor to our current child welfare system. Now residential schools, they were really part of that child welfare system really from the 1950s onwards. By that time, the government had estimated about half the amount of children in school were placed there due to child welfare reasons. And by 1968, that number had jumped up to between 60 and 75% of students. Now, when it came to, how does that connect to challenges today? Well, we have generations of individuals who were raised poorly in those institutions, who did not learn how to be loving partners, who did not learn how to parent, who did not learn how to address, say, behavior problems or discipline in a gentle way, or I should say they reflected or utilized the same sorts of treatments they experienced within residential schools within their own homes. Which then, of course, they also did not learn how to express love. And so we have generations of these broken families who are simply repeating those experiences they had in the school system back in home. So they've basically imported what had occurred in schools back to home communities. And so this is when we get to see some of these cycles of abuse appear in communities. And what residential schools were really good at, what that aim was, as I mentioned, was erasing identity. So it made it very difficult for individuals to answer the questions, who am I? Where do I come from? Where do I belong? As an intergenerational survivor myself, whose mother attended residential school along with her siblings, parents, even grandparents, those are some of the questions I struggled with myself. And so we find programs aimed at culture and language revitalization, programs aimed at assisting intergenerational survivors, means to answer those questions are very good ways to breaking that cycle of violence. It takes individual and collective energies, but together, those are really good, promising ways at addressing some of the challenges we see in communities today.
Thank you so much for that answer. I think it's really important to learn about what happened and the legacy. My next question is, the term cultural genocide is often used in discussions about residential schools. Could you break down what that means and why it is so important to understand?
If you open up the Truth and Reconciliation Commission's final report, the summary report, on page one, you're going to find that definition. And so what they said is cultural genocide is defined as the destruction of the structures and practices that allow a group to continue to be a group. And so acts that can be included as cultural genocide include destroying a group's political and social institutions, seizing their land, restricting their movements, forcibly relocating to other parts of the country, banning languages, banning spiritual practices and ceremonies, persecuting spiritual leaders. And the one that really speaks to residential schools and the legacy is about disrupting the transmission of those cultural values and identity from generation to generation. I'm going to add a little bit more of a broader explanation here on kind of why it was selected to be cultural genocide. I will say, since the original release of the final report in 2015, it is more widely acceptable to call what happened related to residential schools a genocide, full stop. The same, however, can't be said when it comes to the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls in Two-Spirit inquiry and what the types of violence that's occurring and calling that a genocide. I'd say we're not there yet as a broad community to fully accept that as a genocide. So my explanation here is going to tackle both. Now, when it comes to genocide, well, that term was first developed by Ralph Lemkin in 1933 when he was examining German actions within the context of World War II. And so originally it was defined as a coordinated action aimed at the destruction of a group. And he said, generally speaking, genocide does not mean or necessarily mean the immediate destruction of a group, except when accompanied by mass killings. So it's intended rather to kind of signify that there's a coordinated plan of different actions that are aimed at destroying those foundations of a group. And so when that legal definition was incorporated into international law, it was actually more restrictive than the original definition. There were compromises that needed to be made amongst the states, because that original definition actually included cultural genocide. But there are four nations, United States, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, which were very hesitant to include cultural genocide. And if we take a look at state actions against Indigenous peoples in those nations, we can see quite clearly why they would not have wanted that included. And so when it comes to that, Andrew Wolford, a sociologist here at the University of Manitoba, said that colonial genocide really hasn't been given enough attention because of social and temporal boundaries. When it comes to things like the Holocaust or other very large genocides that we can think of that are recognized, often we see a very distinct start and end date. We see a very specific set of situations. However, when it comes to colonial genocide or colonial actions like that, it's a lot more blur. And so he said, because of this, it can be very difficult to try and force this traditional idea of genocide upon, cases where there are these complications. And so what he said is that that application needs to have a closer look at the historical record where programs and policies aimed at either subjugating or eliminating Indigenous people, which were deadly then, are just as deadly today. And so, a couple examples, especially kind of connected to missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, is the number of Indigenous women or women of color dying in police custody, the failure to protect Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit people from exploitation and trafficking, the failure to protect them from known killers. A good example in BC is, of course, Robert Picton, but most recently here in Manitoba, we have the case of Jeremy Sabicki. We also have the child welfare crisis. There are more children, Indigenous children, in the child welfare system today than there were children in residential schools. We have abuse in state institutions. We have the denial of Indian status. And although there were means to return that status, another personal example I will give is because I was born after 1985, I myself have my status back because I'm of mixed heritage. My mother lost her status, but she gained it back. But because I married a non-Indigenous man and because of when I was born, I can't pass my status on to my children. It ends with me. And so then we also look at, say, the forced removal of children, the forced, I should say, the chronic underfunding of services. We have forced sterilizations that still happen in Canada, unfortunately. Both Indigenous women and women of color are still targeted. There's currently a study happening in Quebec to take a look at the prevalence of sterilizations across Canada. And what we see is happening today is women of color in labor being coerced into tubal ligations without their full knowledge of and consent. And of course, that procedure is irreversible. The only place in Canada that has put a full stop is in Saskatoon, and that is because of a 2017 report talking about that prevalence. We still know that this is a challenge we see today. So, all of those pieces, all of those colonial systems and aspects, although are not overt, are very insidiously having their impact through all of these other areas. And again, as I mentioned in that previous kind of question, oftentimes it's very hard to make that connection between those historical experiences and kind of those present day challenges that we have.
Thank you so much. What really surprised me is when you said you can't pass the status to your children. That's really shocking because it's really erasing your identity, and that's really shocking to me. Thank you for sharing. I read that there are many misunderstandings about residential schools, like that the government had good intentions. What are some misunderstandings about residential schools that you think need to be cleared up?
When it comes to myths about residential schools, misconceptions, one of the ones I first want to tackle is a lot of the educational materials that you see today are primarily about the Prairie Province experience of First Nations children. And there are a great number who did attend residential schools, but oftentimes we're missing the voices of Inuit and Métis experiences. Now, we're trying to work towards that at the NCTR by collecting more of those truths and experiences from those community members. And the TRC also tried to address that. There are two specific volumes, one connected to the Inuit experience, one connected to the Métis experience, that are separate from the fuller history. And that is because although there are overarching aspects or experiences that are connected, We're talking about over 150 years. And so policies, procedures, those things change over time. The same can be said about each one of those children's having a unique experience, over 150,000. And as I said, although there may be shared elements, we have to imagine that each one's going to have their own unique experience, some good, some bad. And so when it comes to that aspect, there is a really great article released in 2011 by Daniel Heath Justice and Dr. Sean Carlton, where they outlined 8 ways to identify and confront residential school denialism. And in fact, there have been a number of articles like issued by Negan Sinclair, as well as Raymond Faulkner, that follow up on these 8 kind of main arguments. And I will say, as a genocide scholar, a lot of the arguments that I'm seeing related to residential schools, it's the same sort of arguments that I see when it comes to genocide. So I'm going to outline the 8. I won't go into heavy, heavy details other than to advise folks to check out that article by doing a search on residential school denialism. But first, that question is, what is residential school denialism? While it isn't denying that residential schools exist, what it is misinterpreting the facts or truths about residential schools. And so the first main argument is that residential schools weren't genocide. Actually, if we take a look at what the TRC report said, they said, well, it's cultural genocide. If we take a look at the current definition of genocide, there is a component about the forced removal of children from their parents and communities to another group. Well, that exactly was residential school, and then the 60s scoop. The second is that residential schools are simply schools like any other type of boarding school. However, I will tell you, residential schools are nothing like the Institute Rosenberg, one of the most expensive schools in the entire world, which you can find located in Switzerland. And I believe the annual tuition is something like $150,000 per year. Residential schools were spending less than a dollar per day. For one particular school in 1944, they got $100 per student, $20 of which was spent on food for the entire year for that one student. And so one of the activities I walk some of my classes through is, here's $20. What can you buy in a year that's going to feed you? And I can tell you, there's very little that they can actually buy that's going to sustain them for that full year based upon that amount. And adjusting for inflation, that would be roughly today is if I gave you $25 for the month and I said you have to use that $25 to sustain you for that full month. Knowing inflation, what it is right now, you can imagine it's going to be very difficult to be able to do that. And we can then think, well, that then accounts for the malnutrition and the illness that we're seeing in the residential school when they're really not putting that money in. So we cannot equate residential schools to the types of institutions where children would be going to receive an education outside the home. The third argument is that, well, children were sent to those institutions to learn new skills and become, and I'm doing air quotes, I know this is a podcast, but productive members of society. Well, when we actually take a look at these new skills that the children are being taught, well, it's really skills meant to ensure that the residential school could keep operating. They weren't given enough money, and so half the day students are in class learning the lessons. Half the day they're doing chores just to keep the school going. So it's not really necessarily a cooking class. It is, well, you have to peel this bag of 10-pound potatoes. You have to shuck these peas. You have to wash the stairs. It's not actually skills that are going to allow them to enter into the society, Canadian society, and really kind of ensure the health and living a good life once they left that institution. The next kind of argument we see is the one that you had mentioned earlier, is that the churches and the government, well, they had good intentions. Their idea was about raising Indigenous communities, Indigenous children up, so again, they could enter society. But those good intentions aren't enough to justify the thousands of children who died, the thousands of children who were unfortunately abused in a variety of ways. It does not justify the erasure of Indigenous identity or the genocide that we're inflicting. No good intention could ever outweigh those negatives. But oftentimes, that's kind of connected to this fifth argument, which is, Well, you're ignoring all the good things. What about those children who had good experiences? And again, I will say there is a full diversity of experiences. There are some children where they attended residential school and it was better than their home life. Unfortunately, the reason for this is that their parents or grandparents had attended residential school, so the abuses they suffered in the school was brought at home. So they were then placed in an institution that at the time became safer for them. But when oftentimes they're talking about the good things, when survivors talk about that, it's about the friendships they made with each other under that the shared trauma experience. It was about sports programs, music programs, art, dance, which are all means of escapism. It are ways that they are able to express themselves, show off their talents. But unfortunately, the churches and government did not put money in to help foster those talents. That wasn't what their aim was. And I'll share a good film, and I'll tell you, I love film. I'm a huge film fanatic. I run a free film series here in Winnipeg called The Decolonizing Lens, which we also kind of broadcast across Canada. The aim is to show the work and words of Indigenous filmmakers and other talents. Because you can spend $8, actually, no, it's more like $18 now, where we really want to get that information, those Indigenous stories and experiences out there. So, where I was going with that is Indian Horse, based upon Richard Wagamese's book, also named Indian Horse. In it is a very accurate depiction of youth who wanted to go into sports, played hockey, and unfortunately, it was racism that prevented him from really excelling. At the NCTR, we have a survivor circle to ensure that the perspective and voice of survivors remains through our activities, through everything that we do. And so, one of the survivors, Eugene Arcand, he talks about how sports is what saved his life. But in addition to that, what you see depicted in Indian Horse when those children go to compete against settler teams or go to compete across the country, that was the treatment that they experienced. And it's something we still hear about and see today with racial slurs being thrown at the children on the ice, either from team members, parents, or the communities themselves. Eugene said they never got to play a home game where they had people supporting them. Even when he was attending Labrette, and then had to attend a school which was a split or mix of Indigenous and non-Indigenous. He said they would purposely put the Indigenous children against the non-Indigenous children in the competitions there. So he said that depiction is a very accurate one when it came to kind of the challenges they experienced. And I'll just highlight once more, highlight one other is Fred Saskamoose, who passed away due to COVID-19. He was one of our first Indigenous NHL players. And he actually spoke to the TRC and he said, although he was recruited to play in the NHL, and he was a really great player, he wasn't interested in sports. He didn't want to be a hockey player. All he wanted to do was go back home and go be with his family. And if you take a look at his NHL career, his hockey career, you can kind of see that where he's playing for a little bit and then he goes back home again. He plays for a little bit and he goes back home again. And so that's kind of all connected to we're ignoring those good things. The sixth is there needs to be a balance of good and bad. And so it's this idea that all of the good, so the education the kids are receiving, the sports programs, the arts programs, the friendships they made, all of that somehow has the same weight as the 4,139 confirmed children who died, as to the over 38,000 survivors who submitted applications for the independent assessment process, that is the out-of-court process to address wrongful acts and serious physical and sexual abuse, that it speaks to basically the institutionalized child neglect that somehow has the exact same weight, ignoring all of those survivors who've come forward to talk about that negative experience. The seventh is one I often hear, and it's that residential schools, well, that was just part of the times. There are other types of institutions like workhouses, Magdalen laundries, and the like, where those children or individuals experience the exact same harms. And we simply have to accept that. And that is not the truth. I mean, yes, there are other institutions. However, we have employees from residential schools, employees from the federal government. We have individuals like Peter Henderson Bryce, who was a whistleblower in the early 1900s regarding the health conditions in residential schools, who were voicing their concern of what was happening. And so there were individuals, parents, community members, but also these government employees and other members who were trying to raise the alarm or ring the bell to say what we're seeing in those institutions goes beyond the pale when it comes to the treatment of children in general. And again, we see these reports that talk about the level of violence in these institutions, with inspectors saying the amount of corporal punishment would not be acceptable in a white school. Yet here we see it's acceptable in this residential school. Well, really, the reason for this is they're scraping the bottom of the barrel for who's going to work there because of the long work hours, very poor pay, isolation out there. And again, unfortunately, it allowed for abusers and other individuals to get in there to go around causing further harm. And so this leads me to the final eighth argument, and this was a little bit of a longer answer, but we have this expectation that Indigenous communities need to act, and I'm using air quotes again, civilly, when it comes to these discussions. That is, they should not be expressing outrage, anger, sadness when we talk about it in the news or in public forums. And that if they do express those feelings, well, they're taking a step out of line. That's just too far. Whereas we have individuals like Tom Flanagan, who are given platforms in the news to talk about how the Indigenous fake news is thriving when it comes to missing children and unmarked burials. And so we are allowing these platforms for non-Indigenous individuals to express their own outrage, whereas we aren't allowing the same for Indigenous peoples, Indigenous communities to express that. And they are really being kind of shot down, knocked down to say, you know what, no, that's a step too far.
Once again, that was Kayla Johnston, who joined us for a discussion on Canada's residential school system. Thank you for tuning in for Beyond the Headlines. Remember, you can join us in the conversation by tweeting at us at beyond_headlines, checking out our website www.beyondtheheadlines.net, or by following us on Instagram at beyondtheheadlines. Thank you for joining us. Our second guest is Tyler Pennock, a Two-Spirit reconnected adoptee from a Cree and Métis family in Alberta's Lesser Slave Lake region. Tyler, a proud member of Sturgeon Lake Cree Nation, holds degrees from the University of Guelph and the University of Toronto. With over 12 years dedicated to Indigenous youth social work and community development in Toronto, Tyler brings a wealth of experience to our discussion. Their acclaimed literary works, including Bones and Blood, explore themes of identity and resilience in Indigenous communities.
Good morning, Professor. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Good, thank you. So to begin our conversation, I was hoping that you could maybe provide some background to our audience who may not be as familiar with the topic. Could you provide a brief overview of the residential school system in Canada?
Yeah, it's hard to do a brief overview. Residential schools were a joint project of the Canadian government and several churches, namely Catholic Church, Anglican Church, United Church, and Presbyterian, and others, in order to provide education for Indigenous students, primarily what we would now call First Nations students. Now, its origins come from a great deal of intent around the history of the relationship we were supposed to have. So its origins do come around, you know, for many Indigenous folks, for many nations, this was a promise made by the Crown, right? And so we started with various sorts of technical schools. And what would happen is when students went to these, their families would literally camp outside these schools because, you know, the expectation was we were to be learning from European governments and from the Canadian, what Canadians knew and what the British knew at the time. And that quickly, within a few decades, came to a halt. And then residential schools started gaining the attention of the new, newly formed Indian Affairs Department, which was under State Department at the time. So the Indian Affairs became widely interested in these and started influencing what would be taught in these and what would be done with these. And they became very widespread. Roughly 150,000 students went to these schools, and they were, for all intents and purposes, not really schools. Most of what people learned there was, you know, they learned English, they learned prayer. Many learned simple things like how to clean. The schools were later on, and for most of the time, horribly underfunded. There was no health concern, like no health approach to speak of, really. Horribly underfunded, and so students ended up supplementing the finances of the schools through, you know, various work programs, raising livestock and whatnot, and just a general upkeep of the school. Through these schools, over time, and sometimes immediately, significant amounts of abuse occurred over and above the traumatic events that happened at the schools, with horrific stories of just significant, you know, power abuses, and there's also sexual abuse and physical abuse and whatnot. But also, you know, just the intergenerational trauma of losing one's culture, losing one's language, losing connection to family, and including losing families. Many students, you know, went to school around 5, 6 years old and didn't get released from school until they were 16, 17, 18 years old, and didn't go home. So, you know, I think the term in Australia was stolen generations. There's definitely a parallel here as well, in the same sense. And they did experience that in Australia as well, with boarding schools.
Right. I mean, on the personal level, it's quite astounding. But then also, when you think about it on the broader impact, just on knowledge and culture, as you're saying, gets stolen away. So could you elaborate a bit on like how some Indigenous Canadians who have lost maybe some generational knowledge, like there's a gap? From those who attended these residential schools till the present day.
Yeah, you had several students would be sent to residential schools, and in the 1910s and 1920s, it became mandatory. So they were taken to these schools, and most often they already speak their languages, be it Ojibwe, be it Cree, be it, you know, Coast Salish or whatnot, or whatever. And they'd be speaking their languages by the time they went to the schools, and they'd be not allowed in school to speak their language. Their language of instruction would have been English, primarily at the time. And speaking their language is something that would be punished, right? There's several stories about not being allowed to speak to family members who are also in residential school. So many residential schools separated boys from girls, which completely obliterated any sort of Indigenous sense of gender spectrum off the bat, but they wouldn't allow siblings to speak to each other in many cases. One way to educate yourself is honestly to read any Indigenous authors on this. I mean, even Billy Ray Belcourt, A History of My Brief Body, he sort of opens it in the introduction of several descriptions through the TRC archives of people describing the door going into the residential schools. And the way in which that door became representative of in a change that is almost like world, a sort of a like world-changing event of coming through that door and never being the same person again, right? And the emotionality that he represents in that, and the way in which he ties his own experiences as a queer Indigenous man growing up in Alberta and growing up on in his community, ties direct lines to the trauma that his parents and grandparents felt, even just getting through the door, right, at a residential school, where everything, your language, your stories, the manner in which you tell your stories, your social relationships, everything suddenly comes to a stop.
Right. Well, so on that point, how can Canadians like more acknowledge the truth and like move forward with reconciliation if you're saying that there are these plethora of stories that are out there, but it seems to me that many Canadians are unwilling or unable to access them, maybe through the public school system, or is there anything that you'd like to see changed, I guess, in how we confront truth and reconciliation?
So you'd mentioned unwilling or unable, and I don't see much of a difference between the two, because we are, as humans, we're creatures of habit, but we are also cultural creatures, right? We have, Canadian culture is now awash with several messages that don't quite compute with the history of residential schools. And so anybody who's experiencing or reading for the first time about residential schools, you do have a kind of emotional breakdown because of the cognitive dissonance that occurs when you read something that is so opposed to the Canadian message. And I'll put it out there right now. Like, the Canadian message, the Canadian story is one of peacekeeping, right? It is the narrative we've told ourselves. And it doesn't jive with residential schools. So they're going to have problems. And the interesting thing about truth, not so much about, I'll go into Ojibwe. Like, there are two words I know for truth, Debwewin, and in Cree that would be Dabwewin. And there's also Gwekwatsuin. So one implies a kind of acceptance, a kind of, awareness of the reality, and another is making a certainty, like that something is certain. What that implies, what that means, at least from the language, is that when you acknowledge the truth of something, you have to fully acknowledge the truth in something, and you have to be open to it. You kind of have to examine what it is you believe about Canada and examine yourself and your relationality to this story, to this history. And it's a hard thing to do. It reminds me of, Toni Morrison when being interviewed in the 80s, and she's like, if your history is this of oppressing a certain people, and then when you see what you've done, you have to look at yourself and wonder, who are you? It's a very difficult thing to do. And, to accept the realities and what occurred during residential schools, you also need to accept that the reality is not really real. And that one of the things the TRC did was attempted, and its purpose was to look at the ways in which, like any Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the ways in which this happened, what caused it to happen. But also, now that we're past it in a time sense, what continues to happen? And how can we remove those things in order to prevent this from happening again? That's a very hard thing to do, particularly when your image of Canada is the broader story that we now have.
Right, yeah. It definitely is a shameful part of our past as Canadians. Do you think that there's almost, have you seen much progress? Like, do you think in terms of confronting truth about residential schools and our history with Indigenous peoples? Or are there still maybe certain myths out there that exist or that some Canadians still hold on to?
Oh, it's hard to. And allow me to say, from my experience in teaching, I don't want Canadians to suddenly look at the history of residential schools if it's new to them and say, "Oh, am I bad?" Right? To move away from any kind of like essential evil good ideas. First and foremost, most Canadians nowadays wouldn't do this. And also, most Canadians now have a post-1982 sense of equality. that just doesn't jive. I remember when I was speaking to kids, when I was a youth outreach worker, I was talking to youth in Driftwood Public School. And they're, you know, every, and we were talking fully about what happened in residential schools. And most of the students were like, well, that doesn't work with Canada because of our charter. And that doesn't work because of rights and freedoms. It just doesn't go. You know, to be Canadian and to be faced with that sort of dichotomy is a difficult thing to do, but you kind of have to examine yourself. But what I will say is we have to examine more about Canadian society than just the history of residential schools. We can't take an arm's length look at it. We have to look at the ways in which the ideas that percolated through history still remain. And I'll give you a real world example. Anytime I tend to get into discussions with my parents, my adoptive parents, or other people of the generation of, you know, the baby boomers or a little bit after, there usually comes this moment where they say something akin to this: your people would be still running in the woods, throwing spears at things if it wasn't for Europeans. And I, fortunately with my family, I get to break that down because they love me and say, look at the issue in what you just said. One, it presumes that we have not been a part of Canada since its inception. And we have. We are a part of the society. Two, it's sort of a rehashing of what I, Orientalism in general, a rehashing of like when you look at Hong Kong, people will tend to say that if it weren't for the British, Hong Kong wouldn't have become this financial center. But that was done with the labor of the people of Hong Kong. They weren't suddenly removed. We are not disappeared in the 17th century. Like, we are still here. The other thing that mentions is that anytime we are being referred to vis-a-vis Canada, it's in this consistent relationship to the past, right? They're willing to discuss how we were in the past and not willing to discuss how Europe was in the past, which was decidedly brutal and certainly less advanced than many Indigenous societies, right? So, you know, when we look at the truth of residential schools and the difficulty we have reconciling that history with our picture of Canada, we also have to look at the ways in which we ourselves, as all of us as Canadians, remember that history, how we conceive of Indigenous peoples. Because even when we talk to each other, there is that sort of racist language. There is that oppression there, even as we do it now.
Yeah, for sure. I guess the last question here would be, could you talk a bit about maybe your own work in poetry and how and storytelling and how that is, in your opinion, if it is, that it's a very productive tool for these Indigenous stories to be passed down and something that is quite beneficial if someone does want to educate themselves on Indigenous ways of knowledge?
One of the things that I held back was the conception of us having a lost culture, which is not your conception, I don't imagine, but it's a Canada-wide conception that we've somehow lost our languages and lost. In truth, we have not. And even when I see, you know, when I see Indigenous professors down here in the South talk about, you know, the status of languages, and they're consistently framing the status of Indigenous languages as something that is declining, right? And if you consider all of the past 200, 300 years, yes, we are declining, going from, you know, 300 plus languages now to 80 something in Canada. So, but when you consider only the past 20, 30 years, it's a very different picture. It's a decidedly different picture. Particularly when you talk about youth in the North. These kids are fluent in their languages. They haven't lost them. And it's interesting that when they come down here to, you know, when many come down here to be in an education system, and they do, they have to come, you know, many students in the North who are Indigenous have to come down South to be boarded to go to school. because the high schools kind of don't exist up. They kind of, it's in engagement with Canadian society that they start to lose, parts of the language. But their parents are still alive. Their grandparents are still alive. A major impact of residential school was that students would go and come back not really fully understanding their languages and not fully understanding their cultures and their stories. And then they had parents and grandparents who were taught not to share those things because it was bad, because it was. But the reality is that these folks still are around. And these stories are still around. And as long as we're living, let's say, our culture is very much vibrant and very much real. So anyone telling their story, no matter where they come from. Again, if we talked about the loss of Indigenous culture, let's put that aside for a moment and understand that as also a framing that puts us in the past, right? When you talk to anyone, like from a northern community, like where I'm from, they have maintained their culture, even though their language may have changed, their education system may have changed. There are parts of themselves that they've maintained generation over generation over generation. The loss just isn't there. And so when when you read stories by Billy Ray Belcourt, and you read stories by Joshua Whitehead, and you read, anything from anyone around this time and the generation after me, you see that they are sort of reclaiming their. They're looking at Canadian culture and they're looking at their experiences in a way that is like, we need something different. And we don't have to recreate it. We only need to look at the stories that we have. One of the ways in which I do it is I teach and study a great deal of oral tradition stories, legends, and teachings from now Cree folks and Anishinaabe folks, but there's quite a few. From down south that have been maintained and recorded, but there's several people who tell them. And one of the ways in which I do it is I immerse myself in, the language of those oral traditions, the structure of those oral traditions, and then I try to include that in my work. And it's interesting, people often ask me, why don't you use titles? Because in English, titles are different. In English, titles don't always infer what's happening in the story. Titles also give a blanket over what's occurred in the story. So if I tell you a story about, riding my bike down a hill and falling over because I've seen a crow distract me and I wound up being injured for several hours in this very traumatic event. When you recall that story to someone else after I've told it, you might recall it differently, and as you do so, you tell them, I heard this from Tyler at this point, and this is important to the story as well. But if you simply say the story of a crow or the story of a bike accident, it sort of gives an impression to the story that doesn't really have the fullness of that. And that's how oral tradition works. Oral, you have several stories that refer to each other that give a huge sort of like web of intertextual relationship that gives you clues about the cultures, about the languages, about things like perspective, about gender, about all kinds of things. And if you just title them all creation story or all this or all that, you give someone an impression that is weird, that isn't really the fullness of the picture. But when you actually immerse yourself in a story before you try and figure out the title, before you try and figure out what it is, before you try and review it and compare it to something else, then you're really engaging with, oral tradition forms of knowledge, and you're really engaging with the people that you presume to care about, like the people that you want to learn about. That's how I do it. And I'm not the only one. Another thing we do is in oral tradition, we're consistently referencing outside cultural events. There's this story of in the TRC recordings, there are several rules around media. You spend so much time. There's also a very legal process to the TRC wherein you can't mention names for fear that you might be sued. There's also, this is what you could talk about in terms of like your personal experiences, and don't talk about other people's personal experiences. And you found that the people who are like elders in these stories, when they're telling their stories, they're referencing films that they all watched together or that came out around that time. When we were children was the one they were referencing. They're referencing each other, right? They're referencing the doorway one is one that you see. If you search doorway of residential schools in the TRC stories that are recorded, you see so many stories. And they're also outright naming the folks that abused them. And they're fearlessly telling their stories and going over time and saying, oh, I've gone over time because I'm told I'm not to. Oral tradition is a way, and our stories and the way in which we tell our stories are ways in which we can sort of open the lens on what's possible. Yeah. So if we can challenge the method of how folks understand our stories, if we can challenge, even the notion that if you really want to understand residential schools, you really want to understand Indigenous peoples and our responsibilities to that, read more than one story. You'll find that they interconnect, right? And trust, other thing. And that will lead you to believe that and lead you to understand and trust our experiences, our stories, because you'll see how why, you'll see how much we were impacted by that. Does that help?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Where can our listeners go if they want to read some of your work?
Oh, my work. TylerPenoff.ca. There's links to books and whatnot. It's Brooks Brick Books is where the two books I have are, but there's also stuff through League of Canadian Poets and other articles that I've written that are linked on that website.
Once again, that was Tyler Pennock, who joined us for a discussion on Canada's residential school system. Thank you for tuning in for Beyond the Headlines. You have been listening to Beyond the Headlines on CIUT 89.5 FM. That wraps up our show for this week. We were joined today by Kayla Johnston and Tyler Pennock. Many thanks to them for coming on to the show to discuss the history and legacy of Canada's residential school system. Today's show was produced by myself, Elena Villabona Palomero, alongside my co-producer, Andrew McKay. If you liked today's episode, please like and review us wherever you are listening. The views expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the views of the producers, CIUT, or the Hmong School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. If you missed any of the show, be sure to check out podcasts of all our episodes on our website at www.beyondtheheadlines.net, as well as on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you're a fan of our show or want to stay up to date with policy issues in Canada, follow us on Twitter at Beyond Headlines. You can also check us out on Facebook and Instagram. Be sure to tune in next week as we continue to take public policy discussions out of the hallways and onto the airwaves.